Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Cool, wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Hol dir dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer.
We've got a great show for you coming up, but first a word from Pure Health Research. Now, a lot of people like their hair and they want to keep their hair and they want to grow their hair back. But contrary to what you've been told, thinning hair or bald spots, maybe not even due to just age or genetics, maybe it's much more. And now it's easier than ever to promote the appearance of healthy new hair growth. How? With the help of Regrow Hair Activation Formula. The formula features two enriching blends that contain hair rejuvenating nutrients like collagen, ashwagandha, which is a name I just like to say, L-lysine, and horsetail extract. I don't know what that stuff does, but apparently it works really, really well for your hair. And these nutrients protect your hair from damage and breakage. They reduce the appearance of hair loss, and they can boost the healthy shine and volume as well. Listen to this testimonial from James. He said, I started taking it 2 months ago, and my hair is actually starting to fill my bald spot. Unbelievable. Now, of course, your results may vary, but you can join James and many others in reclaiming the look of fuller and thicker hair growth with Regrow Hair Activation Formula. You receive a free bottle of Metabolic Reds Plus with your order as well. So go check it out. TryRegrow.com/Stu. TryRegrow.com/Stu. You get a supply of Regrow Hair Activation Formula and claim your free bonus gift. It's TryRegrow.com/Stu.
Stu Does America.
Ah, so much to do today, so much. Welcome to the program. Today we're going to do the PulseCast. The PulseCast, it's a brand new feature here on Stu Does America and also the Glenn Beck program on radio. And it's an election forecasting tool, something to kind of monitor the entire space. And I want to tell you about it before we reveal where it is today, what it's looked like over the past 6 weeks when we've kind of been running it in the background without showing it to anybody. And it's kind of going to give you a sense as to where the election stands with Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. So what is the PulseCast? Well, I'm so glad you asked. The PulseCast is a statistical measure of sorts. It is something that I think you're going to like because, honestly, there's a bunch of different measures going on. And these are like, I don't know, maybe a dozen different data sets from all around the world designed to give you a simple and cohesive picture of the consensus state of the race. We use everything from polling averages to prediction markets and fully built out election models to try to kind of like boil this all down, synthesize it for you. Now, you've probably seen these measures before. Sometimes you'll be really excited about them. Sometimes you'll be really angry at them. Some of these metrics are like well-known public-facing products from names that you know. Some are built just by data nerds that are not famous at all. But it's important to kind of look at all of them, I think. And so we're going to do that here with the PulseCast. So why did we create the PulseCast? Let's go there. Why did we create it? Well, we created the PulseCast to basically address all the disparities in how these data journalists and pollsters and experts all interpret the same data. I mean, they're all looking at the same data and they're all kind of trying to look at it and say, hey, this is going to happen. They all have the same inputs and they all want the same output. Who's going to win the election? These differences, however, can lead to a lot of confusion because there are wide gaps between some of these estimates. So our goal with this is to basically provide a more unified and comprehensible summary of the overall consensus. Nate Silver is probably the most well-known guy when it comes to election forecasting. He hosts his own election model on Substack now. He used to work over at 538. That was the first site he did. His former site now exists under the ABC Disney banner, but he took his model with him to his Substack. So he has one formula to do it. The old site that he has is at 538. They brought in somebody else to run that election model. And now it's a completely different model designed by somebody else. They may very well be good faith efforts. They're both trying to get the answer right, I'm sure. But they tell completely different stories as to who's going to win this election. Sometimes I've seen them differ by up to like 20 percentage points. And, you know, these are only two of very many models and averages and markets trying to interpret the same data. So, you know, you look at this and you say, well, how can I make sense of it? Well, that's what we're trying to do with the PulseCast. Now, why are these metrics so different? Well, each and every one of these indicators are based on individual decisions made by individual people, right? These are, it's not like people get so angry at polls because they're like, why didn't you get this exactly right? There's bias here and there. There's bias in everything. And I don't mean that bias in the negative way where you're saying, okay, I want my side to win, so I'm going to manipulate the data. That stuff definitely does happen. But also just people disagree. They have their own beliefs. There's also the sort of statistical bias that's worked into these things. And if you think about it from the very beginning, a bunch of people have opinions on an election. Well, how do I make sense out of that? Well, they have a poll, and the poll summarizes all of that data, right? Pollsters must decide on how to weight those polls. They look at different demographic groups. They try to figure out what is this election sample really going to look like? They realize, they look how to select their samples as they go through. Polling average creators, that was kind of the step up, right? We had polls, and then there was a bunch of different polls saying a bunch of different things. We're like, well, what if we summarize all those polls and we come up with a polling average? Well, polling average creators must, of course, decide on which polls to include. You'll see people like Real Clear Politics. They have a subset and they'll do certain things with it. Other ones will take it and they'll take a much wider swath of polls and they'll decide to weight them based on quality and other variables. There's a bunch of different decisions being made by polling averages. It's not just data. Then you have campaign modelers. They must decide which polls to use as well. They must decide which fundamentals to include. They must decide which historical precedent to consider among, dozens of different variables. All these things are basically ideas to make this. They're all making their own individual decisions. They're all coming up with different reasons to not include this or include this or weight this way. And it's hard to keep a picture as to what all this means, unless you're going to go check dozens of sites every single day, which no one wants to do, except me. So what does the PulseCast attempt to do? The PulseCast tries to not only boil down all of this information into one understandable number, but it's also there to kind of smooth out all of those individual decisions made by individual people. You might get the wrong picture if one person's making a decision that's really going to favor Biden or Harris. Hard to keep track of who's the candidate these days. You might see a decision made that really benefits Trump, and it looks like it's very Trump-focused. You see pollsters at times that you're like, okay, they always come up with good Trump results, and this side always comes up with bad Trump results. It's hard to synthesize all that information. And the very human instinct for most people is to basically do a little doctor shopping when it comes to election time. This poll, my candidate's ahead. I love that pollster. This projection shows my candidate's behind. I don't like them. Both sides do this. It's very human. But look, you come to the show. Why? I don't really understand it, but I appreciate that you're here. One of the reasons that we do this show is because that stuff bothers me. I hate when I read a headline and I'm like, oh, that sounds great. I'm excited. That's going to happen in the election. And then you really, really dig down into it. And it's like, well, they're cherry picking a poll, or they're looking at it in some way that doesn't make any sense. Or you just get to election day and you're like, wait a minute, that guy was totally wrong. Why am I ever going to believe them again? The PulseCast removes all of the, individual biases, at least. It crystallizes everything into one simple percentage. What we're trying to do is attempt to answer the question that we want answered by the experts. Who do they think is going to win? This doesn't mean they're right. It doesn't mean every expert's right. It doesn't mean you should give up if you get a bad number one day. It doesn't mean you should be, you're on paradise if you get great numbers. It's just to give you an idea as to what they're all saying so that the people on your side aren't cherry picking information that you like. The mainstream media is not cherry picking information that they like and not telling you about the other polls. This takes all of it into account. So what does the PulseCast not attempt to do? This is very important. The PulseCast is not my idea as to who's going to win the election. I will do that on the chalkboard thing that we do as we get closer to the election. I'll always make a prediction on the day before and try to map out all the states. It's going to be really freaking hard this year, honestly, the closer and closer we get to it. This is not my idea of who's going to win the election. It's not, you know, Glenn Beck's idea as to who's going to win the election. It's not the Blaze.coms or the Blaze TVs or any of the hosts you know and love on this network. What is their prediction? They'll tell you on their show. I will tell you on my show, but the PulseCast is something different. This is a summary of data experts and what they are saying. What they are saying. Don't get mad at me. I'm just the messenger trying to give you the information, the most complete look at the consensus. And now, as you know, this does not mean the consensus is right. In fact, there's a margin of error built into all these numbers, as you all know. But having a real look as to what everyone is actually saying, it can be really helpful for not only judging their performance retrospectively after the fact, but also generating, you know, it's going to generate, you know, palpable fear for a lot of people. It's going to generate calming optimism for a lot of people. But the bottom line is we just believe you should know what's out there, whether you like it or not. So why is it called the PulseCast? I mean, the idea was basically to have a finger on the pulse of all of these different electoral data sets. It is also an acronym. The acronym stands for Predictive Update and Leverage Summary of Electoral Consensus and Statistical Tracking, which is not something I wanted to actually say over and over again. So PulseCast, that's what it is. So that's what you have. Now, I want to show you what the PulseCast looks like. And before I give you the information, I want you to prepare yourself, because it's not the greatest information for Donald Trump. If you happen to be a Trump fan, you might be very disappointed in this, or at least in the direction it's going. Basically, right now, it's still pretty darn close to a toss-up. And this is what the PulseCast says today. 55.7% chance that Kamala Harris wins the election. 44.3% chance that Donald Trump wins the election. Now, keep this up here for a minute, because I want to walk through what it says. You'll see at the beginning, Trump was ahead. This is in the aftermath of Trump getting Biden to drop out, Kamala Harris stepping in. You go up to that first vertical line. This is where Tim Walz was named VP nominee. That did not stop her rise. It also is not responsible for any of it. That's a whole other story. It rises up to her highest levels, about mid-August. And you'll see it's flat there for a while. That's through the Democratic convention on, you know, starting on the 19th of August. You see it's still pretty flat around the time that RFK Jr. endorses Donald Trump. And finally, that first joint interview between Harris and Walz on CNN. At that point is kind of where it starts to fall and come back to life. Now, I think that's a factor of the end of a convention bump. It's the factor of the sort of sugar high of Kamala Harris's announcement starting to wear off. It is also there's some RFK Jr. factor, I think, in there, probably helping Trump a little bit there. And you see the lines coming back together. Harris was about 55% chance to win around that entire period. You see these lines starting to come back together, and they come back, and actually Donald Trump takes the lead in election projection. And I kid you not, it was the day before the debate. Day before the debate, Donald Trump took the lead ever so slightly over Kamala Harris. That next vertical line on September 10th is the Trump-Harris debate. And what we're seeing now is a period of the debate bump for Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris is, has had a good few days of polling. Her percentage chance of winning has increased. And honestly, my belief is that it's probably going to increase a little bit more over the next few days. My guess is she gets some good polls. She's had a couple here recently. She's going to probably get some other good polls that will show that she's in the lead. These numbers may actually increase for Kamala Harris, but it's important to understand where we are, right? This is still a 55-45 is basically a toss-up. You shouldn't take too much into the fact of, 55, if it's 52-48, it's 55-45, it's 48-52. These are, very close. This is a very, very close election. And it should be how you're looking at this. If anything, this should be something that inspires you. If you're thinking to yourself, well, I think Donald Trump's actually doing well. I'm looking around my neighborhood. He's got signs up everywhere. I don't think he's got any chance of losing. A lot of people believe that. And it's important to understand that what Kamala Harris is and what she isn't. What she is somebody who is definitely better than Joe Biden at this stuff. This is a difficult thing. I can't tell you how many people I talked to before Kamala Harris stepped in when I was begging Joe Biden to stay in and every day coming on the air and just saying, you should stay in, Joe, you're doing great. The reason is that Kamala Harris, while not a good candidate overall, is so much better than Joe Biden was there by the end that people are going to have a sugar high. People are going to get excited about it. And that's what we see happening in these polls right now. She is not an easy victory. Donald Trump really does need to stay on message. He didn't really have to stay on message against Joe Biden. He could have won that election with all the, you know, the talk about, you know, God knows what. He can go off any tangent he wants. He can talk about Hannibal Lecter. He can do all the fun stuff that he does at the rallies. It's not going to hurt him in a Joe Biden campaign. It was still a relatively close election, but he was probably going to win it. This is a totally different situation. He's got to be on his game. He has had many periods throughout his life where he has been on his game. You know, I always say that I think the best campaigning Donald Trump ever did was the last 4 weeks or so of the 2016 election after the Access Hollywood tape. He sensed he was in danger. He got on message. He did really, really well for 4 weeks, and he squeaked out a close election. He can do that again. He's absolutely capable of it. That doesn't mean that he wants to do it. He doesn't always love doing that. It's not as fun. I think he wants to win the election, but sometimes he gets a little distracted. This happens. He's already won an election before. He may have a great path to do it, but he has to be on his game. And anyone who wants to support him, anyone who wants him in the White House, has to be out there being as active as possible. This is a real threat. Kamala Harris is a real threat to the conservative values, to the constitutional values that we've held for a very long time. I don't say that in a way to scare you of Kamala Harris. It's just that, you know, she's very much on the left and is going to do a lot of things to this country that I think will be damaging to it. So beating her in the election, really good way to stop that from happening. So that's where we are right now with a PulseCast. This is something we will have posted on my Twitter feed, you know, every day. It'll also be up on, we're going to do on the radio show every day. We'll feature it here every day, just so you have the picture. You can choose very much to dismiss it if you wish, but it's important to make people know what they, you know, what's going on, and it's important to understand where we are in the race. And again, if you're pessimistic, if you look at that 44% number and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm going to jump off a bridge, just remember who Donald Trump is running against.
And now, Veep Thoughts by Kamala Harris.
I grew up in a household where the term mammary gland was used all the time. Any of the scientists here, you'll know what that means. You know, hormones, it was always, that was part of the conversation at the dinner table.
This has been Veep Thoughts by Kamala Harris.
All right. Thank you very much, Kamala. Okay. Is your teen unsure what to do after high school? Then there's a new 6-week life and career skills course from Praxis that you need to know about. For the past decade, Praxis has helped nearly 1,000 homeschoolers and recent high school graduates launch their careers without college through a mentorship program, and they're bringing their expertise to teens with their new course, Discover. Discover is a 6-week self-paced course designed to equip teens with essential life and career skills, like building a professional network, making money by creating value, developing a vision for the future. These are things that you need, and you're not taught in school, unfortunately. You can do something about this because it includes also a coaching call, a free resume review, a copy of the book, Don't Do Stuff That You Hate. This is good advice for your life. Don't do stuff that you hate. And now for a limited time, they're offering listeners of the show a 50% discount off the course. Take advantage of this. The promo code is STU50 at checkout. You get over $350 off of your price. So it's discoverpraxis.com/blaze. Discoverpraxis.com/blaze. The code is STU50. Discoverpraxis.com/blaze.
Kaffee in seiner besten Form mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Tchibo. In jeder Cubo-Kapsel steckt Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Für Espresso, Kaffeecrema oder Kaffee Grande auf Knopfdruck. Die neue Cubo One überzeugt mit Premium-Design, kompakter Größe und kleinem Einstiegspreis ab 29 Euro. Dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie wird jede Tasse besonders aromatisch mit samtiger Crema. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo-Kapselmaschinen in deiner Tchibo-Filiale und auf tchibo.de.
I'm joined now by Billy Binion. He's a reporter for Reason.com. And Billy, you covered a story. We talk about this stuff all the time. I mentioned before we went on the air, I talk about civil asset forfeiture a lot whenever I see a story like this, because I think it's important. And you are covering an issue here that I think is like tangentially related to it. However, I had never heard of in my entire life. I can't believe it's happening. Can you kind of walk us through this story and And what is going on?
Sure. So it is kind of colloquially called home equity theft. And what that refers to is when someone falls, you know, a little behind on their property taxes. They have this modest tax debt that they might not be able to satisfy, especially when considering, you know, over the years, the government will add penalties, interest, and fees that sometimes make it double, triple, quadruple.
Right.
And so in certain areas, what local governments might do is they might seize your home to satisfy the tax debt and sell it. And then sometimes they're keeping the profit. So there is real, I mean, it, yeah.
That does, just off the, just that very a nice explanation as to what it is doesn't sound right, but it gets much worse than this.
It does. So the Supreme Court actually ruled on the matter last year concerning a woman named Geraldine Tyler, who in her mid-80s, she fell behind on her property taxes for her Minnesota condo because she had moved into a retirement community after a nearby shooting near her condo made her feel unsafe. And so with the rent on her retirement community and the property taxes on her condo, she couldn't satisfy both. Ended up accruing a $2,300 debt on her condo.
$2,300.
Right, which is, in terms of property taxes, is very modest.
Mm-hmm, very modest.
Her total debt ended up being $15,000 because of penalties, interest, and fees.
Which is insane.
Right.
I mean, there's
that
many levels of this.
That alone is its
insane.
Own discussion.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the government seized her home, sold it for $40,000, which is also way under market, and then kept the $25,000 profit in excess of what she owed. And this was happening all across the country. And like you said, it just wasn't really generating much attention, probably because this often, by nature, it's happening to people who are poor, people who might not have a big voice. So when the Supreme Court finally ruled on the matter last year, it was a 9-0 decision, which, you know, we hear all the time about how polarized our Supreme Court is, which is, you know, not completely true, but this is not something that was polarizing among justices at all. In his majority opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts said, of course this is illegal. It's a violation of the Fifth Amendment Takings Clause, which promises that if the government is taking private property, it has to provide, quote, just compensation. And the just compensation being the government cannot give the profit, has to go back to the owner. But the reason this is still an issue and the reason I'm still covering it is what some states did in response to that ruling and in response to previous state Supreme Court rulings, ruling this very obviously unconstitutional process illegal, is they have created these Byzantine debt collection statutes that, as what I wrote, was they essentially comply with the law in theory, but not in practice. So they make it very hard for owners to actually get that surplus equity back. They make the process just like a wild goose chase with all of these, you know, arbitrary deadlines, all these random forms. It's like in Michigan, which is the story that I think you saw. A woman turned in a form 8 days late, and so her house, which was worth six figures, over another tax debt that I think with penalties, interest, and fees in the 3,000s, the government kept over $100,000 profit. And they said, you know, and the courts in Michigan have said that's constitutional because it complies with this debt collection statute because you turned in the form late. And so, you know, my position, I write for an opinion magazine, but I don't think it is a very controversial opinion to say that the government should not be able to steal from its citizens like this. You know, people across the country will continue to debate what property taxes should be. I work for a libertarian magazine, so people can guess where I fall on the issue. I understand that there will be differing opinions on that. And these plaintiffs in these lawsuits actually aren't even challenging that the government has a right to satisfy the debt and seize their property in the process. What is up for debate and should not be up for debate is that the government should not subsequently keep the profit, which is just theft. It's legalized larceny.
Yeah, and that's what was fascinating about the story is there's so many levels of it being crazy.
Right.
Every piece of that you just gave us was crazy because the fact that, like, everyone understands, like, you can see a case where someone is hundreds of thousands of dollars behind in their property to, you know, over, they haven't paid it in 20 years or whatever the thing is. They are going to take the house, they're going to sell it, they're going to pay the debt and give the owner back whatever is in excess, if there is any. That's how I think people would understand this.
Right.
Some of the stuff you're talking about here, they're like $8. They're $8 behind on their property taxes, and they're taking their homes. Can you tell us the story?
Yes. So that was also in Michigan. And so that guy's name was Yuri Raffaele, and he was an elderly retiree, and he fell $8.41 behind on his property taxes. And I think it was just, I mean, obviously, like, he could have gone and asked someone on the street for $10. You know, it was just like a missed bill in the mail or something. It wasn't even because he couldn't satisfy the debt.
And any of us could be. I mean, I absolutely. If you told me right now I was $8 behind in my property taxes, I would be like,
you
oh,
might
I am.
Just miss it.
Right, I may totally just miss it.
So the government, you know, this man is retired and he's like 80 some years old, seized his property and sold it and kept the profit over that. And so that is actually what inspired the Michigan Supreme Court in 2020 to rule the practice unconstitutional statewide. So the reason their debt collection statute, you know, in terms of this woman who I mentioned before, who, you know, fell 3,000 some behind, they wrote that debt collection statute legislators in 2020 after the Michigan Supreme Court came down. So they said, okay, you know, the highest court of the land has says this is illegal. Basically, legislators say, then let's get creative. And several states have done that after the Supreme Court's ruling, you know, made that the law of the land nationally. So it's New York, New Jersey, Alabama, and Arizona. And you can tell with that list of states, New York, New Jersey, Democrat heavy, Arizona, purple, Alabama, Republican. It's just a bipartisan thing that a lot of government legislators want to steal from their citizens. But it is also bipartisan when you talk to people about this, to oppose it, like just if you talk to the public about it. And people might have different ways of talking about it. Like maybe on the left, it's a social justice issue. Maybe on the right, it is more of a, you know, this is obviously not limited to any
property.
Limited, right, exactly, property rights. But we should also be coming to the same conclusion, which is that like this is wrong.
Yeah, it really is. And that's one of the things that always hits me about the civil asset forfeiture thing, which is obviously related to this, where, you know, you're driving down the street, you've got $2,000 in your car. They don't give you, they don't even charge you with a crime. They take your car, they take the money. You know, they'll take the tools that you need for work out of the back of the car, and they'll just keep it, and it'll take you years and years and years to even attempt to get it back. And that's what's so jarring about this, is that every single time I talk to someone and tell them one of these stories, they all agree.
Right.
There is no, I can talk to a liberal, I can talk to a conservative. Everybody is on the same side of that. In some ways, I almost wonder if that's the problem, is why it doesn't get solved, is because there's no like opposition. It doesn't, it's not sexy. No one tweets about
it. Exactly.
I know you guys have done a really good job at Reason covering this, which has been great.
But it's so interesting that you say that, because, you know, I would say that civil forfeiture, it almost feels like low-hanging fruit of like very outrage. Like you read these stories and they almost feel too ridiculous to be real. So I agree with you. I mean, we talk about that at Reason, actually. Like, why aren't other people interested in covering this kind of doggedly? And you know what you said, it is very, these two issues are very related. You know, I mentioned the debt collection statutes set people up to fail. It's very much the same thing with civil forfeiture, where, you know, someone's property will be seized and they're not charged with a crime. And the process, you know, of this person who has much less convicted, like they've not even been charged, the process they have to go through just to get before a judge can sometimes take over a year. And that's a feature, not a bug. Mm-hmm. These laws are written very specifically to disincentivize people. So they'll just be like, okay, I give up. You know, like, and a lot of people, they don't have the money for representation. A lot of people don't realize civil forfeiture and something with home equity theft, it's not a criminal proceeding, so there's no constitutional right to an attorney. So if a police officer of law enforcement takes, you know, whether it's your home, it's your all of your generational wealth, or whether it's, you know, the cash you have in your car itself, your home, civil forfeiture proceedings can also target property. If they take your life savings, you don't have money for an attorney. So there are these like ridiculous stories of people going and like having to represent themselves. But like I said, this is by design. It is to discourage people from being able to get their things back.
Is this how they're getting around the idea that, because this was already ruled unconstitutional and they're still doing it. Are they doing it in a way that are just, they make it such a maze, they're saying,
right.
Okay, yeah, yeah,
exactly.
we complied with the constitutional, the Supreme Court ruling.
Exactly. Civil forfeiture is quite unfortunately still has not been ruled unconstitutional yet. Home equity theft has, but that's exactly it. So like the ruling came down in those four states I mentioned. Michigan wrote their debt collection statute after the statewide ruling. But in 2023, when the Supreme Court said, you know, with the Minnesota woman, Geraldine Tyler, who's now in her mid-90s, I love that a woman in her mid-90s brought down home equity theft. But four states pivoted and wrote these debt collection statutes, which is just so shameless. But, you know, as we're saying, it doesn't get like, doesn't draw a lot of headlines, and that's, you know, that's how they get away with it. You don't, if there's no sunshine on it, how do people know that it's a problem?
I know there are some like legal foundations that do help these. The Pacific Legal Foundation is
one. They've represented a bunch of people, and then of course the Institute for Justice does a lot of great work, more with civil forfeiture.
Yeah, and so is it just a matter of getting one of these cases to be enough light on it to change? I mean, is this happening all over the country? Or are these just really bad apples? How is this looking?
So before the Supreme Court ruling, it was happening all over the country, and in some sense it still is. It's just these states have to get creative about it. I'll give you another example. Yeah. I covered a case in Baltimore where this community organization, Baltimore is obviously a city that has a lot of issues. It is it has a lot of people struggling with poverty. Mm-hmm. And there is a nonprofit in the Edmondson neighborhood in Baltimore that was dedicated to helping this, you know, area that was, you know, historically redlined. A lot of people lived in poverty for years, and they fell behind on their 2018 property taxes, I think. Or might have been a few years before that, but it was another one of these debts that was $2,500, you know, something very modest. And what the city is doing is they are selling the tax debt to out-of-state investors. In this case, it was a California investor that bought their tax debt for about $5,200. The California investor didn't like do a renovation. They just turned around and sold the building for, I think, $139,600. And then they gave the organization the difference between the lien purchase price and the tax debt. So for this building, for this nonprofit that's trying to help all these people in poverty, so these people don't have a lot of resources, for a building that was worth about $140,000, they got $2,500. So it's like, you know, like we're saying, it technically complies with the law, but it's not the spirit of it, you know? I mean, and that's what, I mean, the law should, we should be following the spirit of the law. You know, we should actually want to apply the Constitution as it was meant to be applied. And I think the founders, I think this is something that would have horrified them. I think it would have made no sense at all.
And last one before I let you go. Wouldn't property taxes also drive them crazy? You can never own your own land. You're always essentially renting your own land.
So my pitch to people on this who are skeptical of that argument is I think a lot of people, especially people who don't own a home, do not realize that property taxes are often kind of a second mortgage.
Yeah.
So let's say you are one of these people, you've fallen into poverty, but you've paid off your house, and that's your generational wealth. Mm-hmm. Very important for your family and just your well-being, obviously, because no one wants to be homeless. Mm-hmm. In a lot of areas, property taxes are enormous, so you still have basically what is the equivalent of a rent payment. And if you lose your job, you know, I covered one case of a guy whose wife came down with this horrific case of MS, so he had to quit his job and they were living just off of Social Security. If you're like Geraldine Tyler, the Minnesota woman whose condo was seized, you're a retiree in your 80s and 90s, you don't have that steady stream of income to pay what is often this insane yearly rate. And so what you said, I mean, like, I think a lot of people on the left think that's just a talking point that you never own your own land if you're paying this. But like property tax, it's not just like $50 a month. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's in many places, thousands and thousands. It's like a second mortgage.
Yeah.
And if you have fallen to poverty, you've fallen down on your luck, you are elderly, you are sick, a lot of times you just can't make those payments. And these are like the most vulnerable people in society. And these are the people that the left says they stand for. So we should want to, I would say this should be tripartisan, you know,
yeah.
Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, whatever.
Yeah.
I think this is an everyone issue.
I totally agree. Thanks for all your coverage on this because nobody's following it. So please keep us up to date as these things happen because it's really important. It's Billy Binion. He's sure to check out his stuff over at reason.com. This one's, she underpaid a property tax bill, so the government seized her home, sold it, and kept the $102,000 profit. Ah, that sounds totally reasonable. Billy, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
According to a new report, President Biden has signed off on a highly classified plan that shifts America's nuclear strategy to focus on China as a nuclear threat and prepare for the possibility that the communist nation could team up with North Korea and Russia against the United States. Doesn't that sound wonderful? If it doesn't make you nervous, it probably should. And you should think about whether you and your family are prepared for whatever comes around the corner. It doesn't have to just be nuclear war. There's a lot of things that can come and affect us. As we found out the past few years, there's something you can do to ensure that you and your loved ones have medication on hand when it's needed. It's a solution that thousands of people have already discovered, and it's called the Jace case. It allows you to stock up on medication right now so you're prepared for whatever comes around the corner. The Jace case is a personalized emergency kit that contains essential antibiotics and medications that treat the most common and deadly bacterial infections. And it provides 5 life-saving antibiotics for emergency use. So you're going to be covered for all these basic things that could hit you. You can fill out a simple form online online, and you'll have it in case you need it. Just go to Jase.com, J-A-S-E.com. Enter the code STU at checkout. You get a discount on your order, and you can prepare yourself, and you'll have confidence that your family is prepared as well. It's promo code STU at Jase.com, J-A-S-E.com. The code is STU.
Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer gut, immer günstig, immer vielfältig. Kurz gesagt, frische für alle. Zum Aldi-Preis. Diese Woche Zespri Sangold Kiwi. Das Stück für nur 55 Cent. Oder dunkle Tafeltrauben. 500 Gramm für nur 1,79 Euro. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Well, as you know, the Harris Wall strategy is basically hiding in the basement and never doing an interview. And you might say, well, it was kind of like the Joe Biden strategy of 2020, but that was during COVID, right? It's not quite the full story. This is a new story from Axios. The Harris Wall's media strategy, hide from the press. And they have a new, this is incredible. This is the number of TV and print interviews by presidential ticket. Trump has done 14 of them. J.D. Vance has done 59 of them. I'll show you the graph here. Harris has done 3 of them, and Walls has done 4. Now, again, I don't know what, I don't, their metrics might be a little bit different than mine because I don't count some of their interviews. They're just too pathetic. But so to give you, to boil this down, Harris and Walls combined have done 7. Donald Trump by himself has done 14, twice as many. And J.D. Vance has done more than 8 times as many interviews as the combined ticket of the Democrats so far. Now, there's more detail in this. They talk about Harris 59 days and Walls 44 days since he's been the candidate. Of course, way more interviews for Trump and Vance. Local TV interviews, 7 for Trump, 15 for Vance, only 1 for Harris, 3 for Walls. National print publications, 1 for Trump, 8 for Vance, only 1 for Harris, 0 for Walls. National TV interviews, 2 for Trump, 24 for Vance, who really is going out there and doing his job. I mean, you can argue you don't like J.D. Vance, you don't like some of the stuff he said, you don't like some of his answers. He's at least out there doing this on a daily basis. Press conferences, Vance has done 12, Trump has done 3, 0 from Harris, 0 for Walls. Absolutely incredible that this is going on right now. In fact, it's actually so bad that Harris and Walls are actually doing fewer interviews than Biden-Harris was doing during COVID, even in the when they everyone was acknowledging they're doing a basement campaign. Absolutely incredible that that is going on. Now, Walls at one point, you know, local media was on TV a lot. He was, you know, he likes to kind of do his shtick. Oh, look at me. I fish and I hunt when he doesn't know what he's talking about anything. But that's what he does. And he's even shut it down. That's obviously by direction from the Harris campaign. The Axios story says Harris's team believes limiting interactions with the press is the right strategy, even if it frustrates reporters, because Trump and Vance may get more attention for their interviews, but that often brings negative attention when, you know, Vance had to, defend his childless cat ladies thing and all that other nonsense. So this is a straight out strategy. They are communicating this to reporters. This is what we're doing. And they're doing it anyway. And I would just warn reporters. And first of all, we should give credit to Alex Thompson and Tori Van Oot, who did this at Axios, pointing this out. We need more of this. We need them to be called out constantly. And when I say we, I don't even mean, you know, conservatives or, you know, whatever, Republicans, whatever you think. I mean, like, the American people and voters. This is a terrible precedent to set. Katie Hobbs did this in Arizona when she just decided, I'm not going to debate in this particular race. And she wound up winning the race. And now you've seen more people avoiding debates since. This is a lesson that is going to be learned by candidates. If you let them get away with doing no interviews, doing no press conferences, doing no debates, not even announcing or confirming what their policies are, as a candidate, why would you do the opposite? What would your reasoning be to go out of the way to talk to adversarial reporters if you didn't have to do it? And all these candidates are going to learn this. It's not going to just be if you think, like, I'm a Democrat and I don't care, I just want to win. Wait till next time when you have a candidate that maybe is a little bit, you know, handles the media a little bit differently than Donald Trump. How are you going to get them? How are you going to find out what their policies are? They're not going to tell you anything. This is a terrible thing, not just for the media, who should be, as a chorus, coming out and denouncing this tactic from the Harris campaign, but also for voters. It is a terrible thing for the country, for our republic. If our representatives aren't even going to answer to the people that they are representing, where does this leave us going forward? There's a story came out earlier today that the guy in Alaska was sending hundreds of threats to six Supreme Court justices. Guess which six they were? Shockingly, everyone's reporting that it's the conservative justices. They didn't like those rulings. And you know how crazy people get. Now, look, there are nut jobs that are doing stuff like that. But there are also crazy people in our government who want to pack the court and get the same result where the conservative votes in the court don't even matter. The Constitution doesn't matter. At First Liberty Institute, they call this assault on the court what it really is, a Supreme Court coup. Right now, if we unite our voices and we take action together, we can put a stop to the radical left's plan to take control of the Supreme Court. The future of the court and, of course, preserving an independent judiciary is in our hands, and we can do something about it. First Liberty Institute is doing stuff about this all the time. They've been taking action for years and years and years and years. And if they're looking now to try to get a million patriots like you to stand up and, you know, make their argument heard for the Supreme Court, for the independence of the Supreme Court. We can safeguard the independence of the judiciary just as the Founding Fathers intended. Say no to the left's Supreme Court coup. We can secure the blessings of liberty and protect the future of our constitutional rights for our children and our grandchildren. So go to supremecoup.com/stew, supremecoup.com/stew. You can learn how to help stop the radical left's takeover of the Supreme Court through First Liberty Institute. It is supremecoup, C-O-U-P, supremecoup.com/stew.
Sanctuary of Truth.
I don't know about you, but I just cannot believe how much this city is completely falling apart.
Me neither. This used to be an amazing city, and now we have all these right-wingers in here. They're killing it for all of us.
Yep, yep. And this is after all the work that we've done to make this a better place.
Right, we passed all those community programs, and then we raised the taxes on the rich to pay for it.
Yeah, I mean, it worked perfectly. Mm-hmm. Because that chased all those rich fat cats right on out of town.
And since all those criminal rich bastards are gone, we didn't even need any more police
right,
on the streets.
Right, now there's no more harassment of people of color. It's completely extinct.
Well, they do get harassed by the drug addicts and homeless vagrants.
Well, I mean, that's just part of the grit of the city.
Part
of its charm.
Mm-hmm. Amen. And now that all those cops are gone, we're not putting users in jail for their addictions. I mean, they can do drugs right out of the open just like God intended.
Right, and finally, everyone gets the right to their own little patch of pavement to rest their head at night.
Yeah, and drool into a growing puddle of their own urine.
If that's not the American dream, then I don't know what is.
It's like we've been saying, every man needs a sewer grate to pass out on next to a pile of human waste.
I gotta say here, I gotta stop and say, I don't like the term human waste. It's dehumanizing to both the vagrant and to excrement.
You're absolutely right. I'm sorry. I should correct myself. I know now that terms like that don't support my allyship, and I have committed a microaggression both against the person and against the poo-poo.
I understand. I really do. We all commit acts of systemic racism every day because of the color of our skin. And by the way, can you believe these white, corporate, white people are closing up shop?
They're white, first of all, and I'm glad you got that out there. Mm-hmm. But I know, they're not only creating grocery store deserts, but also bank deserts, clothing deserts, makeup deserts, dessert deserts.
Yeah, and what about the ice cream? Every ice cream store is now closed and covered in blood from the latest city stabbing festival.
Ah, corporate greed at its best, at it again. I love how they blame poor people who are just trying to make ends meet.
Just trying to make the two things come together. And doing it, by the way, by filling garbage bags worth of merchandise and peacefully walking out the front door and selling it on eBay. Where's the problem?
Every person has the right to go into a store and loot the things they need to survive along with all the other things in the store.
And look, I've said it before, and I don't know how many more times I'm going to have to say this. No human is illegal.
You got it, brother. And no crime is illegal.
I mean, that is why we help make this into a sanctuary city.
Right. A sanctuary city for people to be able to do drugs, steal stuff, and crap on the sidewalk. What more could you want?
I mean, we had it. We had it. We did all of this great work, and then the right-wingers come in and screw it all up.
I know. I can't believe the way this city is falling apart.
Sanctuary of Truth.
All right, you just saw that last comedy bit. We got another one going up right now on YouTube. YouTube.com/StuDoesAmerica. Kamala's greatest hits going live on YouTube right now. YouTube.com/StuDoesAmerica.